Change doesn't wait. Sometimes it storms in, sometimes it creeps quietly, unfolding in ways we notice later. It stirs in boardrooms, classrooms, streets, and communities, wherever people act with purpose. What moves you? A vision? A challenge? A belief in business as a force for good? And what holds you back? External factors or limiting beliefs? I'm Gary Watts, and this is Moved, the podcast of 289 people inspiring change. I'll be speaking with people exploring what first moved them, what they've achieved, and the challenges they've had to overcome, both outside and within. Each episode is about human performance, leadership, sustainability, doing the work that matters, and the moments that change everything. This is Moved. Today, I'm joined by Truyn Resterick. He's one of the UK's most creative and influential voices in sustainable innovation. He was the founder of Hubbub, which is a charity behind campaigns like ballot bins and community fridges, and that was pioneering ways to make sustainability engaging and fun. They've worked with partners including IKEA, Starbucks, and Virgin Media O2. Twice won Charity of the Year, recognised as Global Leader of the Year, and in 2021, received the Business Green Lifetime Achievement Award. In 2022, voted by peers as the most influential person in the UK's recycling and resource sector. And having stepped down from Hubbub in mid-2022, he's now building Sizzle, which is an initiative redesigning how products and services are delivered so that sustainable choices become the easiest. Under Sizzle, Truyn has launched Treasure Gardening, which is a circular social enterprise turning waste into high-quality horticultural products like Wonder Fuel. It's a peat-free compost, and I know my wife will be interested in that one, actually, Truyn, so we'll have to talk more about that one. It also sits on Tetra Pak's Global Sustainability Advisory Panel, advises the Esme Fairbairn Fund Foundation and the National Lottery Climate Fund, and most recently, just earlier this year in the summer, was appointed a trustee of Carnegie UK, bringing his experience to shape collective wellbeing strategies across the UK and Ireland. Truyn, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Gary. I think all that just shows how old I am, I think.
It's a fabulous introduction. I read that and I'm so impressed by all of the things that you've been doing.
Thank you.
Yeah. So fabulous to have you here. Maybe we could just start by hearing a little bit more from you about your background. And I guess the key question on that background would be, when your passion for sustainability began?
I think it started after I left university. I thought I was pretty unemployable. I went back to Plymouth, where my parents lived, where they were laying off lots of people from the dockyard. So my first role was to try and find jobs for highly skilled people. And we realized that actually a lot of the jobs were about making the use of things that would normally be thrown away. So they would now be called green jobs. They weren't back then. And from there, I went to Friends of the Earth and became initially a waste campaigner and then somehow ended up leading their fundraising team. And I think at Friends of the Earth, I got a real passion and understanding about the scale of the environmental challenges we face. But they're a campaigning organisation and I'm quite practical. So everything I've done since then has been about how do you take these really complicated, somewhat abstract issues, which might not be at the forefront of people's minds, and make them accessible, make it easier for them to do the right thing, but do in a way which is not full of doom and gloom and despondency, but actually puts a bit of a smile on people's faces and shows like the positive side of environmental action rather than what we often get, which is the graphs of doom telling us we're all in big trouble. So that's really sort of, in a nutshell, how my career has progressed.
Yeah, I really love that. It comes through as I was reading all of the things that you've been doing in the past. So it was with Friends of the Earth that you really noticed the scale of the challenge, but then wanted to bring that to practical ways of,
Exactly. Friends of the Earth was an incredible organisation at that time. It was led by a man called Jonathan Porritt, who's quite an inspirational environmentalist. Mm. And, they were one of the first organisations to highlight the impact of climate change. They were probably one of the leading organisations to get something called the Montreal Protocol introduced, which has basically protected the ozone layer, saving thousands of, perhaps even millions of people from getting skin cancer. They looked at waste regulations, they looked at the rainforest. So it was a real fast-track learning about the scale of the problem. And I think I've always been struck about the disparity between what scientists are telling us for many, many years now about what will happen if we carry on as we are, and the seemingly lack of concern from politicians and some companies about how we need to change things.
So can you tell me a bit more about the, because you notice the scale of the challenge, but then you had the spark to, how can I make this practical? How can I make it fun? How did you make that leap from something that's big and scary and huge to trying to approach it in a more engaging way?
I think you always have to start from where people are rather than that big environmental message. So I think the campaigns I've developed have always started to try and understand what people know at the moment, what they're willing to do, what they're able to do, and basically encourage people to take a few small steps to start with and realize, they're not weird if they do that, and actually it's got multiple benefits. So, a couple of examples, the campaign with IKEA. We went out to all their customers and listened to what they wanted to do in their lives. And with IKEA's massive product range, we sort of promoted the products that would help them do that. And then we encouraged them to talk to their friends and neighbors and be advocates for that change. It was a campaign called Le Gomme, which means not too much and not too little, just get your life in balance. That's been massively successful. And then the ballot bin, which you mentioned in your introduction. We went to one of the busiest streets in London day and night and watched what was happening and found, the most littered item in the street was cigarette butts, quite often by drunk blokes, young blokes. So it was like, how do you stop a drunk guy dropping their cigarette butt on the floor? Didn't think a little sticker would do it. So we took the leap of, well, we think a lot of young men like football. So we created a voting bin saying, who's the best football player in the world? Is it Ronaldo or Messi? And you vote with your cigarette butt. And at the time, it was clearly Messi was the best player. So we stacked the bin so it looked like Ronaldo was winning. I think we had 84,000 Facebook likes on the first day. We had the Daily Mail sports department ringing us up saying, what footballers and what do smokers know about football? And it just mushroomed from there. We started with one bin. We then set up a social enterprise. We sell bins all over the world. And it's nudge technique. It's like, how do you get people at the point when they're going to do something to actually slightly change their mind? And there are a lot of behavior change techniques you can use like that, where people are doing the right thing, but they're not feeling like somebody's nagging them or being critical. It's just a fun, engaging way to change the behavior and get people to think about things slightly differently.
Yeah, I imagine people respond to things a lot better that way rather than being lectured, but it's something more fun, something engaging, a bit more light-hearted.
Exactly. I mean, the great speech didn't start with I had a nightmare, it started with I had a dream. And I think people want a positive. And I think the other thing I've noticed, is not necessarily to lead with an environmental message. So the community fridges, of which there are now over 300 throughout the UK, they're basically cold storage areas where food that would have been thrown away, perishable food, is stored, and then anybody in the community can take. And people do it because it saves them money, they have access to healthy food. They're also cutting food waste, but that's not the primary message around the fridges. It's like, here's a way to make resources go further, but you're saving yourself money, you're being healthy, and you're contributing to the local environment. And I think those messages are really strong.
Can you tell me a little bit about when you started Hubbub? What went through your mind in terms of deciding to create that?
Yeah, I'd set up another charity which I'd been at for over 20 years, and I frankly was getting a little bored. And I felt that I'd learned enough to try a different approach, and I had a choice. It's like either I take this organisation on a completely new path where everybody working there will hate me for it, or I leave and try and set up something else with the learnings I had. And I think the ambition behind Hubbub, well, the ambition was to partner with big progressive companies but to make everything more lifestyle related, to look at the companies that were doing really well in engaging with people, like Innocent Drinks at the time. There were others who were taking a very positive, light-hearted approach, but thoughtful approach to sort of creating change. So that was on one side. That was the philosophy behind, or the values behind, the organization. And then I really wanted to create an organization that sort of respected its employees. I know that sounds really corny, but gave people a chance to sort of flourish in their jobs, and to enjoy their jobs and be creative, and not be punished for making mistakes if they were trying to do the right thing, and just have quite a supportive environment. So I was trying to do those two things when I set up Hubhub.
And it's quite a big thing to actually create something. It's often like a bit of a leap of faith, or you're taking a risk. What went through your mind in terms of, yeah, I need to do
Yeah,
this?
I mean, it's an absolute nightmare. I think you've got to have a supportive family because it's a massive financial risk. The first 2.5 years, you're constantly on a financial tightrope, battling with survival, and you just got to be very stubborn and very determined and very committed and enjoy what you're doing. So, that's the downside. On the upside, you're free. You can make mistakes, you can take risks. The mantra at the start of Hubhub was learn fast, learn cheap. Because you have space to truly understand what works, and to like leap on the bits that do work, and forget or learn from the things that hadn't worked. And that's quite an uplifting place to be. But you need a certain mentality, and I think I've realized belatedly in my life I'm better at that bit than the running an organization. I don't like the detail of having to deal with sort of 60, 70 staff. It's just not what I'm good at.
Yeah, focus on what you love. So the playful approach, I want to keep coming back to that, I think, because it's so interesting. And I think I've seen it sometimes, but not to the extent that you have been doing it repeatedly and like throughout. That seems to be a really common thread. I'm just really intrigued where it came from. Was there a role model or some people that you'd seen take that approach with things that you thought, yeah, that's a better way?
Well, I think I've sort of always had a slightly mischievous nature, so I think that's where some of it came from. But I think sort of more deeply than that, working at Friends of the Earth, who were amazing at highlighting an issue and then probably not that great at getting people to engage with it, it's because I realized it's exhausting to be told bad news all the time. You either just think, oh, this is not for me, I've got too many other things that are important, whatever I do doesn't make a difference, it's too big globally. And I sort of really got to understand that that's not the way to do it. What do people respond to? What do they talk about? It's talk about together. It's the funny, the quirky, the unusual, the surprising. And I think that's always where that's the bit that's always interested me. And I think you see it now. There are some brilliant comedians out there, using humor to sort of get important points across. So I think, if you do it well, it does work. You obviously have to tread a fine line between flippancy and seriousness, but it has, if the core message is important and you get it across in a fun way, then I think that's the key.
Yeah. It's funny you say that. I was just speaking to Stuart Goldsmith just earlier this week. I don't know if you know Stuart Goldsmith. He's a climate comedian.
Oh, okay. Oh, yes, yeah, the climate committee. Yeah, I do know.
Yeah, he's got a podcast. He's does climate comedy on the circuit. Yeah, we were speaking just the other day, and I didn't even know climate comedy was a thing. But yeah, climate comedy is a thing, and he's one of the leaders in it. And it makes so much sense because it's like one of those things that you can easily have all of the kind of dark messages and so on. But yeah, I can't wait to attend one of his gigs actually to see that firsthand, and hopefully he's going to be on this podcast at some point. But yeah, to bring humor into some of those topics, in the appropriate ways is I think a really clever way of doing it.
Yeah.
So you have a slightly mischievous personality potentially. Is that how friends would describe you?
Yeah, that, well, they probably described it in many other ways before that, but somewhere in the list lower down, there might be that there. Yeah.
Yeah. So the campaigns then, you've touched on some of them. Maybe it's the ones that you'd want to draw on again, but of all of the campaigns that you've been involved with, what's been the one that you've been really proud of that you've thought that has shifted people?
I think it has to be the community fridges. I mean, what one of the things I always sort of set out when I'm thinking about a campaign is, can anybody from any side of politics argue against the core message? And so one of the core messages I thought nobody with any common sense is going to argue against this is food waste is stupid. It's bad environmentally, it's bad financially, it's bad socially. Pete, you can't argue that we should be eradicating food waste. And yet, I mean, if food waste was a country, it would be the third biggest carbon dioxide emitting nation in the world. It's
Goodness.
that important. And it's throughout the chain. It's from households all the way through, farms to households, basically. There's food waste in the entire process. So it's like, okay, the campaign's going to tackle food waste. And what we realized is that, there are food banks which are fantastic, absolutely incredible, but they don't deal with, most of them don't have fridges or freezers that deals with the perishable food. So you've got retailers chucking out food that is still edible 2 or 3 days, before it really goes off. Because they want to restack the shelves, or Nando's have got chickens that, they've heated right at the last minute that could be wasted. So the community fridge was, let's create a space in the community where retailers and households can take food that would have been wasted, put it in the fridge, label it, make sure it's safe, and then anybody in the community can take it. So it's not like a food bank, anybody of any wealth or any background can take the food because it's about cutting food waste. And the idea started in Spain, in the Basque region, and then it was in Berlin, and I saw it and I thought, right, we're going to try it here. And the initial reaction from everyone was like, that's never going to work. People abuse the system. Somebody will die of food poisoning, blah, 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 blah. So we went to a town called Swadlincote in Derbyshire, a tiny little town, put a fridge in, worked really well. Then it was like, well, it's bound to work there because everybody's terribly nice. So then we took it to an inner London estate and it worked even better. And I think, and then we just gave the idea away and we found the money. So the co-op put lots of money into developing the fridges, the National Lottery. But we basically said to people, well, you run your own fridge and we'll give you the resource to do it. So it was giving away the idea. So it was community led, which made it for me more likely to succeed. And it's now a network and, people are learning from each other and then they're expanding to look at cooking skills. So I think it has that longevity that perhaps some of the other campaigns I ran haven't.
Yeah, so it really touched people and it worked in different contexts, in different areas, and still having an effect now as a network. I need to look at where my nearest one is. Yeah, there probably is one not too far from me.
I hope so, yeah. But I think it's that concept of giving away. I think a lot of one of my bugbears about certain charities is that they try and hold on to everything and they logo it and it's like theirs. And then, I think sort of true community action means giving people the resources and the skills, and the confidence really to go and do it themselves. And the charities I always saw Hubbub's role, I'm not sure it's the same now, but I always saw Hubbub's role as being like the catalyst that gives people the ability to do things for themselves.
Yeah, it's like almost like an open source approach to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I love that. And then, as of the campaigns, is there any campaign that you would think, I wish that one would have gone better, one that you had the spark for, but it didn't quite?
Yeah, I think so. It's many years back, but after Brexit, we decided to go to one of the towns and cities that voted for Brexit and go and see what was happening. So we went to Oldham, and
Yeah, I know it well.
yeah, we went and spoke to the council, and I spent about 2 weeks in Oldham listening to the residents and trying to work out We had a pot of money. It's like, if we use this pot of money, what could we do to make a difference? And as you probably know, in Oldham, there's lots of terraced houses, and they have alleyways at the back, and a lot of the alleyways had been sort of turned over to sort of fly tipping. There were rats, overgrown. So what we did was we worked with the council and a number of streets, and we blocked the alleyways off, and we sort of basically greened the alleyway with the citizen, the people in the street. So we put in planters, putting some cricket nets into them. There are a whole load of different things, and it was quite transformative in that, people then stopped playing on the street in front. They started playing in the alleyways. The children were safer,
Oh,
and they
wow.
started talking to each other a bit more. It was a genuine community build, but it was so expensive and took so much time, and it just wasn't for us as a small charity, and it just wasn't replicable.
Yeah.
And the council obviously didn't have the resource to do it. And I'd for me, that's really sad, because I saw even the police were saying crime rates were down because there was less antagonism on the street. It had so many breadth of benefits, and there are so many places, particularly in the north of England, like that.
Definitely.
I couldn't make it work, basically, and I still don't know how it could work, but I saw the benefits of that really intensive approach. So that slightly saddened me always.
It's really interesting because I can it immediately resonates what you've described, because in a city areas where places have run down, there's often not enough green space, and it's not just that access to green space will necessarily make things better, but I do think it's a factor that can help. And for you to actually see that you did something on, I know, those kind of back streets and alleyways and run down inner city communities quite well, something that you do that just makes them feel a little bit safer and a little bit happier, because green, I think most people would say that if you walk in nature, it immediately has an effect on your mood, that you are bringing a dose of that to a place that it typically wasn't and was working. And actually, I would have sensed that there would be a business case in, safety going up and crime going down and so on. But yeah, okay, that's really interesting. I would still feel like there's something to be visited there. But yeah, I'm sure it's not without trying. Yeah.
And I think the thing that really, it's like creating, you described it as that safe space where, predominantly the mums with the kids, they would stop talking to each other. And, in a world where unfortunately more and more people are communicating via social media, where people are settling into their tribes and having existing views reinforced, having that space where you can actually go and talk to, sort of a Bangladeshi person talking to an Indian person talking to, somebody from the Romani community all in the same street, breaks down a lot of the perceived barriers that there are between those communities, because they make a connection through their kids, or they wonder why the tomato plants have all died all of a sudden. It's so I think it has got that additional benefit, but trying to put a sort of financial value on that and justify huge amounts, relatively large amounts of money on very small schemes is just really difficult.
Yeah, I can appreciate. So just coming back to the ballot bins, because I find that one really interesting too. And particularly, you talked about Messi, Ronaldo, and getting people on the street to choose which bin they would put it in based on that. And as much as you learn about, or you're experienced in sustainability and charity and social causes and all those sorts of good things, as much of that you do, that's also human behavior. And I'm just really interested in, I don't know if you ever looked into behavioral psychology, but what have you learned about human behavior from things that you've been doing, such as the ballot bins?
I mean, yes, it's sort of the whole human behavior thing is drives, well, everything, doesn't it, really? So it's like, how do you encourage people to do the right thing without falling into the nanny state and, how dare you tell me how to live sort of type narrative, which is quite strongly out there. And, like I said, there are different techniques. The nudge technique is great for a one-off action, but, it doesn't change wider mindsets. It's like an instant thing. You either do this or you do that. So there are different types of behavior change techniques for different sort of actions. But the one that always works is called social diffusion, which is basically if you get a group of people together and you encourage them to talk about something and make changes as a group, that they can sort of educate each other, they can encourage each other, they can point out areas where things don't work. And it's why things like Weight Watchers worked really well. It's because you get groups of people, they might be competitive or they might be supportive, but it's that group activity, that social connectiveness that makes it work. And there's a really good example of it, which I can't remember who it was who did an experiment where, when you get in the lift, you always face the door. That's common thing to do. So they did an experiment with some actors where there were four actors or so, and they faced the other way. And somebody got in the lift, and initially they got in and faced the door. And by the time they got off, they were facing the other way because they didn't want to be the odd one out. And they assumed that if everybody was facing that way, then they should be too. And I know it's a very small experiment, but it does show the desire of people to be seen to do the right thing and to follow the social norms. And I think the trick around environmental stuff, which can seem a bit quirky and out there, is to show that actually, if lots of people are doing it, it's the right thing to do. And you get others to get involved. So the analogy I use is a bit like a choir. If you're in a choir, you always get somebody sings very loudly and off key to start with, and that's the start point. So you need the singers, and if you get the singers, then everybody else will join in. So that's the congregation joining in, and then you'll always get the people at the back who just ignore it or mime your way through. And I think a lot of behavior change programs try and get the people who are never going to sing, but actually you want the singers to sing loudly, and that persuades the rest of the group to become involved. And that to me is how social change and social diffusion works.
Yeah, I love that. You articulate it really well. I don't think I'd even heard the term social diffusion itself, but it makes a lot of sense. I love the lift story. It's amazing, isn't it? People are we are so suggestible. We want the network effect is significant, and I love that. Just a really simple thing, because I would, we would always, I think, face the door on a lift. How do we get out? But just takes a few to be looking the other way, and then suddenly we're doing that too.
You don't want to be the awkward odd one out.
No. And if people are seeing through social diffusion the right thing being done in a, maybe on some things that are sometimes hard or they feel less comfortable in, people leading by example, and sometimes that can give you critical mass that it goes. It's fascinating. I'm going to look into social diffusion more. Thank you.
Yeah, there's a great book called Tipping Point.
Tipping point. I have heard of that book.
Which you only need to read the first two chapters because it basically keeps repeating itself, but
Yeah.
that's the
Tipping
gist.
point. Who's the author for that?
Oh, I can't remember. I knew you were going
I'll look.
to ask me that.
Don't worry. I'll look it up.
I think it begins with a J. I don't know.
I will look it up. There's probably other people going to look it up off the back of this as well because we're suggesting it. You mentioned family and friends, I think, earlier. Have they ever been involved in the campaigns that you've been doing? How much have they had the book?
Weirdly, my wife worked at Hubbub for a while, so that was
Oh, did
sort
she?
of quite close engagement. And she's always been sort of like very much into the sustainability stuff. I got currently got two young boys, one of whom is fascinated and really gets it, and he's like loves growing, and is sort of wants I think wants to be a bit like podcast, sort of a social content creator.
Bring him in, he could work with me.
He really gets into it, and I think the other one just hopes that the new business I've set up does really well, so he have to work.
Right, yeah, we'll hear about that new business soon because maybe he'll be with it in it with you then. Yeah, interesting. That's good. Zooming out a little bit, from your perspective, where do we stand in the UK today on sustainability?
I think we've always, whether we believe or not, we've always been a leader. We've always been a leader on climate change globally. We were recognized by other countries for the steps that we took at global conventions. We were one of the first countries to introduce climate legislation. We've been at the forefront, and I think a lot of countries have looked up to us and actually needed us to be that singer, if you like, to be the one that's been brave enough to take the lead. And it's always been a non-political issue. So, Cameron's party, the Conservatives, the Lib Dems, Labour, they always sang from the same hymn sheet broadly. They, even if they had slightly different views about how it should happen, Boris was a great advocate on the world stage. I think the sad thing now is, as with many issues, it's become politicized. Farage has taken quite an aim at the term net zero. Trump is obviously leading the charge about, drill baby drill type messaging, and unfortunately, the Conservative Party has followed suit. So, from a point where there was a consensus, there's now not, and as a result, we've stepped back from our leadership role globally, and everybody's sort of going very softly, softly around it. And you're seeing that with companies as well. They're probably doing the same stuff, they're just not talking about it. And that is a problem, because if people don't talk about it, it's not perceived as a problem. And you are starting to see people questioning the science. And ironically, it's a time when the science is getting stronger and stronger. And ironically, it's probably at a time when all of us are seeing more extreme weather events globally. We're getting to crunch points on some things. So we've got very high food inflation at the moment, largely driven by extreme weather events around the world, which is affecting food supply. The UK is basically playing sort of Russian roulette with its water supply. We're using more water carelessly. There are longer dry periods, got a growing population. We're starting to face some of the realities that scientists have told us would happen, at a point when the politicians are starting to question it, and where people are beginning to become more dubious.
Yeah, it is really interesting actually, because it does feel like, yeah, the evidence and the things that you see are more crystallized than ever. And yeah, that everything you've just described, because this year is it's 10 years since the UN SDGs were launched. Later this year, it's 10 years since the Paris Agreement. And I've had this conversation with a number of people actually around how it was the case. It did appear to be the case that there was really global consensus on these sorts of things. Global consensus, we need to act. Nearly, I think all nations got behind the UN SDGs. They're huge and like beautiful, and really galvanized Paris Agreement as well. And this topic, it never appeared to be a political football as much, and where now it really seems to have become a bit more of a political football, which is quite a shame. Hopefully it's a phase that we come through quite quickly. So what opportunities do you, because I agree with you, the UK has appeared to me to be very much a leader on so many of these things. Actually, just in one of the last episodes, I had David Hawes of Net Zero International talking about how actually UK definitely was one of the first to sign up to many of these things and make such an impact early. And we halved our carbon emissions since 1990s, what David was sharing with me. So what opportunities do you see in the UK that we can start to be better?
So I think, I mean, first of all, we've slightly got ourselves in a bit of a mess on it through our language and terminology. So nobody really knows what net zero is. And if somebody doesn't know what net zero is, it becomes a bit of an open goal for people to define it for their own purposes. So, that's what, frankly, the right wing are doing. They're attacking net zero, and they're lumping a whole load of things into net zero. To give a false narrative, really, about what it is. But I think we need to strip back the language and talk about, things like national resilience. It makes sense for us to grow more of our own food. It makes sense for us to be more independent on our energy sources. It makes sense for us to use our water resources in a way that we're not going to run out. There are so many things that we could do which have environmental benefits, but actually which make UK a stronger, more resilient, more financially profitable and enjoyable place to live. And I think, going back to that, who can argue with that? That could fit into a right wing or a left wing narrative.
It
So
would.
I think there's resilience. I think from what I've seen, the strength of environmental action often comes from communities rather than from government. And I think people are crying out to make better connections in the locality, to feel safe in their locality, and to feel like, that they're more part of a community group. So I think there is community action that we can take. And I think we can also be a leader. We were a leader on technology. You just have to look at what China's done around electric vehicles and is doing around renewable energy. That, there are market opportunities. The sustainability section, the green jobs section, is one of the few areas of the market that's actually booming at the moment. So, the government battles on about gross, gross, gross. Green jobs is the growth area. And it's fulfilling and it's important work. And we're just not addressing or embracing the opportunities that a sort of more sustainable UK could yield.
Interesting. I want to pick up the thread around national resilience. So when you use the term national resilience, I can very much imagine that that's something that everyone would get behind, pretty much without exception, that people are proud of the country and resilience is it we'd want to be resilient. So running with that, I have to ask the question, when you think about national resilience and the things that we can do to self-sustain more and grow things more, how would you bring in the playful part, the things that you've done in the past? Do you see an opportunity there to almost gamify and make fun and national
Yeah,
resilience?
I think so. I mean, I don't ask me for an idea off the top of my head, but you can turn anything into, you can almost take the mickey about, the what makes Britain great again. You can sort of point fingers elsewhere. You can do it. I'm sure you can do it. So I mean, but it depends how brave you want to be. So there was a water company, I won't name them. We were doing a there was a water shortage about 7, 8 years ago. There will be constant water shortages, but this was one a few years back. And we were trying to like think about how you could encourage people to not waste water. So we sort of like discovered how much time different ages of people and different sort of sexes were spending in the shower. And young blokes, young girls spend lots of time in the shower. And then we were like trying to find out why. And I'll leave let your imagination run wild on that one. But you can use it. You can use things like that in a really playful way to make a point about, what do you do in the shower, And it's sort of like, I don't know. I think there's anything you can do in terms of resource use, which you can make funny or headlines or sort of playful, just to make people think differently.
Actually, coming back to the Stuart Goldsmith, the climate comedian thing, he has something called climate confessions, because we probably all have them, even like however small, if you think about it. Many of us might want things to be better and greener and so on, but actually probably most people have climate confessions, and they can maybe in some cases be funny and more light-hearted rather than too serious. Consumption and like water waste, but consumption in general, if you had a magic wand, what would you change in terms of how society consumes?
Well, I mean, we do massively overconsume, and I'm slightly getting tired of the we can recycle our way out of everything, which is like the mantra of the plastics industry, because we've just got to simply stop producing so much and consuming so much in the first instance. And the one that really gets my goat is the fashion industry. We're seeing fashion become faster and faster and faster. We base it, and the French, interestingly, have just started to think about how they can make that more transparent and stop taxing the production side of things, so that people spend perhaps a bit more on some clothing but buy less of it. And I think what's happening is, companies like Shein, really cheap clothing, people order three or four things at once, pick out the one or two they like, and then send the other stuff back without any thought at all about what the environmental impact of returns are. That stuff's got to be transported backwards and forwards. It might not even be used when it gets back to the factory because it might not be sort of in the production line anymore or the sales line, so it's probably being burnt or, sent over to Africa or Eastern Europe. It's just crazy that the consumption of clothing and fast fashion is a ridiculously unsustainable industry. And, I see lots of initiatives from the fashion sector, but they don't stack up to anything because the issue is you produce too much and it's of too low quality in the first instance.
I guess there are things like Vinted that are trying to increase the extent of the circular economy with respect to, it seems to be getting quite big actually, but yeah,
But
massive
you talk
production of,
about fun. I mean, there was a great example in Berlin. I think it was Berlin. It was Germany anyway, where they had a vending machine and they said, get sort of five t-shirts for €1 each. So like everybody was running up and they put their euro in and it said like, oh, before you get your t-shirt, why don't you just watch this video? And it was basically a very short video about the exploitation, about how that t-shirt or those t-shirts have been made. And then it just said at the end, do you still want the t-shirt or do you want to donate the money? And most people donated the money. So I think that's a great example of how somebody used some form of communication which got people to think before they bought. So another nudge technique, just to help people get that connection, understand that, their cheap t-shirt is actually exploiting probably quite a lot of people in the supply chain and certainly nature en route.
I guess we're often on autopilot or don't always see, imagine the chain behind a certain thing. Tell us about Sizzle then.
So I mean I'm getting on a bit. So I'd got to 60 and Hubba, was doing really well. It was about 8 million. It just won charity of the year. And I thought, well, when's the best time to leave? Well, who is it who said it's best time to fix the roof is when the sun's shining. So I thought, got loads of money in the bank, it's got a strong leadership team. I'm starting to do things I don't enjoy. So it was really weird to leave something you set up, especially when it's going well. I think most people couldn't quite believe I was mad enough to do it, but I decided to go. But I think there was another reason I went, which was we'd done lots of campaigns around plastic and cutting plastic use, and then there was the whole Attenborough and Blue Planet, and people were really concerned about it. And then COVID comes along, and then the plastic single-use plastic consumption rocketed because everybody was like, "Oh, I want to be safe," and disposable plastics a way to make sure, I'm looking after my hygiene and personal health. And it suddenly made me realize that, behavior change stuff's important, but it's only one part of the story. And what you've got to do is you've got to provide products and services that are as good as what's out there already, but better for the environment. So the challenge I set myself at Sizzle, and I still don't know how to solve it, is like, how do you create products and services that make it easy for people to do the right thing. So they even if they don't think about it, they're doing the right thing. And I decided that perhaps the best way to do that was to get people, unusual groups together to collaborate, who to sort of come up with solutions. So that was this rather ambitious, foolhardy probably objective of Sizzle. But I felt I'd achieved quite a lot in my career. So it was like, well, why not have a go at something that's sort of tilting at windmills a bit.
Yeah, really interesting. And tell me about the compost.
I mean, I've no idea how I ended up here, but I advised the Childhood Foundation, who've been trying to stop peat being used in gardening for donkey's years, and the legislation still hasn't been introduced. And so they asked me to go and have a look as to why, and one of the reasons was, a lot of the peat-free products were useless. They weren't very good. So people were like trying it and like, nah, that doesn't work. So I linked up with, so I call him the compost guru. He's a complete geek on composting and sort of like said, okay, go and try and make a peat-free compost that works. And so he came up with this mixture of, so it's a bit of green waste, it's coir, which is coconut husk waste. It's off cuttings from furniture and wood bark. So they're all things that would normally be thrown away. And he's created this sort of magic mix into a compost, which we've called Wonderfuel. And then we've been doing growing trials in it, and it works amazingly. It actually works better than peat. So yeah, rather foolhardily, I said, well, let's try and produce it. So we've set up a social enterprise. We're producing this compost, which is amazing, but it's a premium product, and we're trying to sell it into the market. And boy, it's difficult. The garden centre world is quite conservative. With a small C, there's some very big players who don't really want anybody else to enter it. And then you've got quite a lot of public scepticism about, well, it's peat-free and brine, it's peat-free made from rubbish. That's even worse. So, we're fighting an awful lot of headwinds to get it into the market. So, it's financially on a total knife edge, but it's the right thing to do. And I think it's also about promoting the circular economy and that resilience point, which is we're chucking stuff away that can be used, and at the same time we're destroying probably one of the most important ecosystems that we have for carbon and biodiversity and birds and plants. So, and why are we doing it? We're digging it up when actually we can make a way more sustainable alternative. So it's been fascinating for me. It's the first sort of product I've created, and but it's really made me realize how difficult it is to take something which is the right thing into a market where really the market doesn't want it.
So, if you're listening to this and you want a, or if you know someone who would like a playful way of introducing a product like that in a garden center or something local, then you know where to come.
Yeah, please
Because
do.
it works better than peat. Yeah, it sounds fantastic. Yeah, where would we, until it's on the,
So you can get it online. It's the website is treasuregardening.co.uk, and it's called Wonderfuel. And there's a stage one for seeds and a stage two for sort of containers and plant pots. So, it's quite easy. You know what you're going to get. And it will be the first. We've got other products coming. So if we can get over the hump of financial uncertainty, but there will be more circular economy products which work for the gardening sector.
Well, my wife is a huge gardener, so I'm gonna get a bag of Wonderfuel, and hopefully, you
Brilliant.
never know, someone might be listening. So there you go. Really interesting. You spent decades making change with humour and lightness. That definitely has stood out to me as I've looked at it. What advice would you give to young people who want to work in sustainability?
I think, well, first of all, it's fascinating. It's a fascinating job because you have to think of a whole breadth of things. So you use every bit of your mind, really, to from the analytical to the playful to every aspect of your life. It's a fascinating subject to get into. And I think you should, young people should look at the many opportunities that exist for fulfilling jobs in the sector. And you can see them coming. So, from electric cars through to heat pumps, through to resource conservation, to sort of like more creative use of resources through sort of deposit return schemes, that there's a myriad amount of jobs out there which are fascinating. And employers are looking for those people who have those sort of transferable skills and that knowledge across a whole range of things. I think it's quite a hard sector to get into, and it's quite a hard sector to define. So I think if you're doing sort of whatever course they're doing, if they're doing a course, is to think about how do you put a sustainable spin on it. So if you're doing design, how do you think about the circular economy? If you're doing engineering, how do you think about resource use? If you're thinking about product development, what will happen to the product after the consumer's used it? Those sort of questions. And then, I mean, for me, the practical experience of like going and working, with a community group or an NGO or something like that, as a volunteer in your spare time, just to get more of a grounding in it, is also really helpful.
Thank you. It's a world that's really fast moving. It can feel uncertain. People can sometimes, be worried or not sure how they can have an effect. What practical things would you want to leave listeners with, the things that they can actually do to make a difference?
Yeah, I think, I mean, well, don't lose hope. So any small step is a part of a bigger change. So I think that's the first thing to say. And really, you know, your diet and your food, that's the first thing. That's, you know, you can make a real impact with small changes around, you know, food. And then that can be just thinking about how you can cut food waste, you know. Maybe write a list when you go shopping, or just think about your meal planning or batch cooking, or, you know, perhaps shifting away from sort of one red meat a meal a week to two or more, you know, or perhaps looking at how you can perhaps, if you've got any space at all, like a balcony, sort of grow your own herbs and just sort of connect with nature that way. So, you know, that's I would start in the kitchen. That would be my first point, and start thinking about how you can have a sort of more sustainable diet, and how you can look at, you know, reducing what you're chucking out in the bin, and actually save yourself some money and get a bit healthier on the way.
Yeah, really nice tips. You'd get a bit healthier, you'd feel a bit better. They're good things. 3 years from now, you've been even more successful. What happened?
Well, Treasure Gardening would be solvent. Yes, that would be a start. I think I'd like to continually try and push people to do more, like probably do less myself, but encourage others and sort of try and provide whatever guidance I can from my experience. And I'm definitely going to be writing a book about how you create change, I think. And that will have a lot of humor in it. I think that's If I can find time, I'd like to do that.
Yeah, I look forward to it. I'll add Tipping Point and that book to my reading list.
Might have to wait a while for the second one.
If people want to find out more about you, community fridges, treasure gardening, follow your work, where would they go?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, I've set up quite a lot of organizations, so it's quite complicated. But I mean, I'm currently at sizzle.org.uk, but I set up Hubbub, which is hubbub.org.uk. I set up Global Action Plan, which I think is globalactionplan.org.uk, and then I set up a recycling business which is called Recora. So yeah, somewhere spread amongst that mass of things, somebody might find something of interest.
I'll make sure to put every single one of those in the show notes.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, true. And it's been absolutely fabulous to have you on the show. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks a lot. I've really enjoyed talking to you again.
Thanks for joining me on this episode of Moved. If it sparks something for you, subscribe and share it with someone who's looking to make a difference. I'm Gary Watts, and I'll see you next time as we explore what moves people and ideas forward.